This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Where presidential campaigns get scared off. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what we have for you during this program.
With New York holding its primary on Tuesday, a look at why the Empire State is often referred to as a haunted house for candidates.
In sports, the one thing the Golden State Warriors can't take from the Bulls, despite overtaking Chicago for wins in a season.
Country music star Jennifer Nettles from Sugarland is here to discuss leadership.
And it's a group of people known as the Digital Wedding Crashers. They like to look at the photos of couples that just got married, even if they don't know the bride and groom.
When I check Instagram on Sunday morning and I happen to come across somebody who posted a photo from a wedding and it has a hashtag, I just click, 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 and suddenly you can see an entire gallery of a stranger's wedding. And it's actually kind of fun.
Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes on digital wedding crashers. She's here in about 20 minutes. Well, rarely has a presidential primary with so much national importance had so many local favorites, as New York does this Tuesday. Rick Hampson, national reporter at USA Today, says the current campaign has revived a state that used to be a political dynamo. Rick, how so?
Gordon, New York, as you know, as well as anybody, is sort of a famous graveyard for political candidacies over the years. Out-of-town candidates come in and they get beat up. The Empire State makes candidates. It's made many presidents, including the Roosevelts. But in recent years, the place has fallen into irrelevance. The presidential primary is often late in the season. It's often fallen on the same day as other primaries. So the result has been that while New York is important in the general election and certainly important for raising money, it really hasn't been the kingmaker it used to be. That changed this year, obviously, because the presidential race is still very much alive. And you have three local candidates all very much in the mix: Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump.
Yeah. So what happened along the way, say, that made New York this haunted house or graveyard of political candidates until now, I guess?
It was known as the graveyard because for a variety of reasons. One of them was very aggressive local news media. A lot of newspapers, a lot of TV and radio stations, just a lot of people going after the candidates, including two tabloids who are often fighting a circulation war, the Daily News and the New York Post. Plus, you had these sort of local characters like Ed Koch, Reverend Al Sharpton, who really knew how to play the angles. They would befriend certain candidates, not befriend other candidates. So the candidate coming in had to navigate these treacherous shoals, and a lot of them simply weren't up to the task. This is where Al Gore's candidacy for the Democratic nomination ended in '88. It's where Jerry Brown came to the end of the road in 1992, and it's where Pat Buchanan was really pummeled when he came in '96, seeking the Republican nomination after having won New Hampshire.
So as things stand now, as you point out, New York really could play a key role in selecting both nominees.
Exactly, because the election is both things are still up in the air. Not only could they play a crucial role, but the feeling is that this may go to both conventions. So the very specific kind of delegate allocation matters. It's a situation in which every delegate in every congressional district could be important. So the interest here is just off the scale. There's been nothing like it for years. As one former advisor to Rudy Giuliani told me, the circus has come to town. And people are really excited.
We're speaking with Rick Hampson, national correspondent at USA Today. He's got an interesting look at New York as the primary approaches on Tuesday. He says, for presidential campaigns, Empire State, a haunted house. Have any of the three candidates so far, in your mind, been able to use their New York roots to their advantage. Bernie Sanders may try to get away with it, but that he just can't get away from that Brooklyn accent.
He certainly sounds the part, doesn't he?
Yes.
But this, as I say, these are treacherous shoals. Bernie goes into the Daily News editorial meeting, and they're chatting, and somehow the subject of the subway comes up, and one of the questioners says, "Do you plan to ride the subway?" And Bernie says, "Yeah, sure, yeah." And how will you do it? And he says, "What do you mean?" And they say, "Well, how will you get on it?" And Bernie says, "Well, you use a token."
Yeah, yeah.
Not knowing that the token hasn't been accepted in the New York subway for many years. It's been replaced by the magnetized MetroCard.
Yeah.
So there's a gotcha moment there on the most elemental sort of thing. But then Hillary Clinton tries to make some hay on this. So she's next day, she's out there riding in the subway, campaigning on the subway like an old New Yorker. But actually, when she tried to swipe her MetroCard, it didn't work.
Yeah.
So then there was this hilarious sketch on Saturday Night Live of Hillary, you know, attempting repeatedly to get through the turnstiles, you know, to no avail.
Thanks, Rick. Rick Hampson, national reporter at USA Today. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, country music star Jennifer Nettles. The new high-performance Dell Latitude systems are the most secure, manageable, and reliable business-class laptops and two-in-ones so employees can do their best work. Outfitted with the latest Intel Core processors, your team can reduce downtime by 50% and boost productivity with 4 times the performance. Make your work beautiful again at Dell.com/radio. Again, Dell.com/radio. Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to the state that went from 49th to 10th best in corporate business income tax, where 2,000 burdensome and unnecessary regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years, and is now home to the 6th best entrepreneurial climate. All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice of your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Country music star Jennifer Nettles, who you may know from the band Sugarland, is among those trying to stimulate and inspire a new generation of leaders. A 4-H alum, she's the new national campaign spokeswoman for the Grow True Leaders campaign from 4-H, and joins us now with award-winning 4-H member Thad Hughes. Jennifer, what did 4-H, first of all, do for you?
You know what, Gordon, I have said this before, and I will say it again and probably numerous times as we celebrate over the next couple of days here in D.C., I would not be doing what I'm doing today and at the level that I'm doing it if it weren't for 4-H. I had the opportunity to meet other kids who were like me, who had dreams, who loved the performing arts. That was my specific 4-H project. I had the opportunity to travel. 4-H got me on my first airplane, just a little girl from South Georgia's small town. I would have never been able to do those things. And in it, it lit a fire in me for sure. And I'm super grateful for it for that.
Well, this is a little bit of a in the weeds thing, and kind of my own observation. My wife and I have said, because we like Sugarland, have said it just never seems that Jennifer Nettles takes a song off. Like, you never mail it in with a song. Is that, I don't know, is that on purpose? Is that something that came from the 4-H or from family? Where's that from?
Well, I tell you what. I mean, a little bit of both. But with 4-H specifically, I was a part of a program called Clovers and Company, and it was a performing arts troupe. And we traveled all over, not only in the state of Georgia. That was who it was sponsored by, was the university system there and the 4-H system there in Georgia. And we traveled all over, and I learned a lot from that program. I learned about professionalism. I learned about being timely. I learned about, what it is to be around, as I said earlier, other kids who have the same amount of passion. So you're not going to phone that in when you've got everybody else, you know, and all your peers up in your game the whole time. So I definitely think that was a part of of that very high compliment that you gave me. Thank you.
Let me ask Thad. Do you feel the same way, Thad? Are you kind of getting that similar experience here?
Oh, yes. 4-H really helped me figure out what I wanted to do with life. I was a youth who grew up really liking science in general, but with 4-H, I was able to take that general liking and hone it into a technical understanding of engineering in general. That helped me to go on and start a number of educational robotics teams in my area, which really gave youth in my area a place to shine. If they weren't someone who really was great about sports, or it really helped them have their talent shine and be who they were in engineering fields so that they could go on and become great leaders in their community as well.
We're speaking with country music star Jennifer Nettles and also Thad Hughes, who's the 2016 STEM Pillar winner from the 4-H, and we're talking about the 4-H's new program, Grow True Leaders Campaign. Jennifer, how are you, by the way, juggling work and family these days now that you're a mom?
Well, you know, people ask me, Gordon, like, how do you balance work and family life? And I have joked and said, well, first of all, when I became a mom, I threw away the word balance because that no longer exists. I look at it as a dance, and I try to step in and step out on cue and give my best, you know, in each role whenever I am whenever I'm in it. So, I don't know how well I'm juggling it, but I'm definitely enjoying it.
Very good. And you got on tour, right? Doing some things now ahead of the new album?
Yeah, on tour. The new album comes out, Playing With Fire, on May 13th, and I'll be on tour till the middle of June out to support that. And, and actually, even fun and exciting tidbit, and also bring it around full circle, I'll have some pieces of merch that are 4-H inspired.
Oh, very good.
That folks that are at my shows can see, and that also vice versa you can get on the 4-H website, which is 4-H.org. That's 4-H, it is, .org. So people can check that out and check out the Jennifer Nettles merchandise, as well as get a whole bunch of information on what 4-H is up to now and growing these leaders.
Do you bring your son out for some of the shows, or how does that work?
He goes with me everywhere.
Oh, okay.
He is a little gypsy baby, and he traveled on the road with me on tour.
Gypsy baby. Jennifer Nettles, the new album, Playing With Fire, out May 13th. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Have you heard of the digital wedding crashers? Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Holmes says, in a Sunday morning ritual, people are poring over strangers' wedding photos on Instagram. Brides and grooms make it easy by choosing a distinctive hashtag. Elizabeth, seriously, this is a thing?
So I don't know if this is what you do on Sunday mornings, but I have found when I check Instagram on Sunday mornings and I happen to come across somebody who posted a photo from a wedding and it has a hashtag, I just click, 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 and suddenly you can see an entire gallery of a stranger's wedding. And it's actually kind of fun. You get to see a lot of times the bride and the groom in her dress or the bridal party or the first dance. And so you can kind of be a digital wedding crasher of sorts. And I am not alone. It seems a lot of people do this, and a lot of brides are increasingly like very into having other people look at their weddings too.
Well, okay. Oh boy!
All right, mutual love affair going on.
I see. All right. So why are brides interested in having, say, perfect strangers drop in? Do they like being told by a stranger, hey, you look great, you know, look like you had a lot of fun? Like, is that what that's about, or what is this?
Well, I think a lot of planning goes into a wedding, and brides usually get very excited about their wedding, and so it's the same reason why people put a marriage announcement in a newspaper or have, you know, a wedding website or magazine cover their wedding. I think people like to get a little attention around their wedding. The way that wedding hashtags started is it's on social media. It's a great way to kind of keep track of the photos that your guests share, and it's a nice sort of digital archive of sorts to have a group of photos that are from your wedding that you don't have to, you know, say, hey, send me your photos, what photos did you take, kind of thing. And so it's a way to have them all in one place. And sort of the next chapter of that is by putting them out there publicly and tagging them for you to have, a lot of other people can see them too.
Is not any kind of risk to doing that?
Well, I think it's pretty harmless. You know, I mean, of course there's always going to be, you know, the chance that somebody posts something inappropriate, or,
yeah.
But I think around a wedding, people are usually, you know, guests feel this duty to, like, show up and be a good guest. And, you know, that used to mean, like, getting out on the dance floor when everybody started dancing. And now I think it means, like, taking a picture and posting it with the hashtag. Like, it's become this kind of guest responsibility. And a lot of people really like it. I mean, I've gone to lots of weddings that have hashtags, and I've posted and, you know, been a part of it. And it is fun to see everyone else's photos. And, you know, from afar, I think there are a lot of very glamorous people that have very beautiful weddings, and it's kind of just, it's pretty harmless to just click through and enjoy from from the comfort of your own home.
That would make me feel very inadequate. Well, you had a wedding at a $50 million mansion. You know, I had mine at an $18 a plate reception.
I haven't even been married for 5 years, and hashtags weren't a thing. I think I would have had one if they were a thing, and I didn't have one. So it's come on fast and furious here. The problem is, the more people that have hashtags, the harder it is to come up with a unique hashtag that can be yours and yours only. So there are these services now that are wedding hashtag generators, where you plug in, you know, your name and your groom's name and your wedding date and location, and they'll spit out a bunch of options. But I did talk to one girl who said, you know, she came up with a list and, you know, had margaritas with her girlfriends, and they settled on one. And for the most part, the grooms get on board. Like, they're not just sort of like passive participants here, that they tend to get kind of active in the hashtagging. And then there's nobody better at hashtagging a photo at a wedding than people who have just gotten married, and so they know the importance of it, and so they post a lot of photos too.
How about that? We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter and style writer Elizabeth Holmes. Her piece is called "The Digital Wedding Crashers." I guess if it was a distant friend or relative, I could see combing through, but a stranger's photos, I just don't know.
Camps. Okay. So there's two camps. There's one is that kind of random acquaintance or somebody you might know somehow, or a friend of a friend kind of thing. And those are always kind of fun because you might know some people there.
Yeah.
But then there's this whole world, you know, that social media has sort of brought on of these kind of, as one person called it, obscurely famous people. And so it's, you know, in the fashion community, there's a lot of them, and they have really sort of over-the-top events. And over the weekend, designer Jason Wu got married in Tulum, and I definitely saw his hashtag, and I was like, click, click, click. I want to see, you know, Diane Kruger gave it toast, and you can see all these, like, you know, more personal details than you would get if, you know, just, you know, Vogue wrote up the wedding or whatever. You get a little bit more of the personality of and the time that people had, and so it's a little voyeurism, but I think it's pretty harmless.
What about, I mean, wouldn't it be more exciting just to dress up and be an actual wedding crasher? Just go to your local hall, pop in with your camera, and say, hey, what's the hashtag today?
Quite as glamorous, and again, that comes with the severe chance of a downside,
right,
of getting kicked out. These weddings are, I mean, the weddings that, of the brides that I talk to have very over-the-top, very stock-worthy weddings, I found. And, you know, these weddings are increasingly made for social media. There are a lot of, you know, not only is there a photo booth, but there's usually a lot of touches or activities that are meant to be photographed and shared.
Oh, is that right? Oh, man.
Because, yeah, if you go to a wedding and you don't take a picture, did it really happen?
Wall Street Journal writer Elizabeth Holmes on the trend of digital wedding crashers. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office, and it's so easy. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. Stamps.com even gives you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. And the setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your very own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com. Enter Deal. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, an estimated 48 million Americans are affected by foodborne illnesses each year. Do you have a good handle on what you're putting in your mouth? We're joined now by biosecurity expert Dr. Mark Tamplin, a CDC advisor and also author of a new book called Phage, a scientific thriller about threats to America's food supply. Mark, what are the big risks?
Two of the most obvious ones that came out to me and really stimulated my ideas about the book is when we look at our food safety system in the United States, it's one of the best in the world. We do a great job from the food processing plant into the restaurants, you know, and then it's up to the consumers to do the right thing. But what we currently aren't doing well, and I think we've let our guard down, is what's happening on farms, particularly with products like ready-to-eat produce, things we're not going to cook, the salad greens, the lettuce, the spinach, those types of things. So that's one scenario. And the other is, who do we let work in our laboratories, and what types of safeguards do we have in place or should have in place so that we're sure that the people that are using pathogens are people that we can trust?
Mm. All right, so you propose that rhetorically, but so I got to ask you then, who are these folks? Do we know?
Well, let me give you an example. I work at a university. When we have a new student come into the university, if they're going to work on a research project related to pathogens, we basically do zero background checks on them. We do train them in occupational health and safety and all those types of good things, but most of the people that work in labs don't have a background check like we would expect them to, and that even goes for government laboratories. Now, the government labs that work with what are called select agents, the really deadly organisms, they have to have good background checks. But there's a lot of bacteria. We've all heard of E. coli and Salmonella. These are organisms that are not considered these high-security bugs, and we basically don't have any cameras in the labs watching what people do, nor do we look into their backgrounds enough. So that's a gap that's really simple to fill, and I think that's where we ought to be putting a lot of our attention.
Are we at greater risk today, Mark, for foodborne illnesses than ever before, or has a threat remained constant? How do you characterize it?
Well, you know, we do think that we're having more control, but one of the problems we're facing today is that we have an estimated 50 million foodborne infections per year in the United States. That means one out of six of us suffer from food poisoning, and upwards of 3,000 people die. Those are all big numbers, and we need to be worried about those. But the kinds of things that we can do with those foods is just be sure that we're handling them properly, and that we're trying to keep those levels down as much as we can. And we know that there's a lot of new food safety programs that have been implemented, but the problem we're facing today is we have a growing population, we have a very complex food supply, lots of people are moving our foods around, and that leads to problems that when an accident happens, it can affect thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah. I heard something once, and it's been years now, but I'll bring it up. Somebody suggested it shouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that when you buy an apple from the grocery store and you bring it home, stick it under the sink and wash it actually in soapy water and then rinse it and eat it. Is that over the top?
No, that's not over the top at all. And that's a good scenario to bring up, Gordon. Thanks for that. Because an apple presents, you know it's got typically a waxy or a very smooth surface. And we can do, by washing it, we can make it very, very clean and sanitary on the exterior surface that we're going to eat and bite into. The products that are challenging us today, going back again to the lettuce, is that those products have, as we all know, have lots of wrinkles in them. They're rough surfaces, and if they get contaminated by dangerous bacteria in the field, when we bring them into our home and rinse them off, we normally can't remove any more than half of them. And that's the challenge that we face. That's why in my book and on my website, marktamplin.com, I really emphasize that we need to put more of our focus into these large farms that are producing foods that we need to expect to be safe.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Tamplin. Again, the book is called Phage, and that's P-H-A-G-E. 21 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. When traveling, most of us are looking to save any dollar possible. Airlines don't make it easy because they whack you with fees when you need to change travel dates. Here's how to avoid the charge from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's a dilemma for travelers. You buy an airline ticket and you have to change it. How can you do that without getting charged? Caitlin Pitzker of Kiplinger's has the answers. Caitlin, do all airlines charge you to change tickets?
Well, the rules that I specifically looked at for my recent piece was actually about tickets that were purchased very recently. So if you realize you made a mistake within 24 hours, most airlines have a rule that will let you out of it because of a rule that's on the Fed's books.
What if you're not in that 24-hour period?
That's the tricky part. So for this, we were specifically looking at that 24-hour period, which is really a great opportunity. Let's say you find some great tickets. You're at home tonight. You're browsing, and you find some great tickets to your dream location, but you haven't asked your boss for permission off from work yet or something like that. You can book those tickets as long as you're prior to 7 days before the flight, so you're not booking last-minute tickets. And then most major airlines allow you 24 hours to cancel them. So you could go into work tomorrow, talk to your boss, make sure you can get that vacation time, or talk to your spouse, make sure that they're in agreement, things like that. But this is a 24-hour window.
So if there's no 24-hour window, what's next?
Well, you know, then you're going to be looking at cancellation fees unless you have some sort of very unique or extenuating circumstance. But as I was saying, the rule that we really focused on for this piece was about changing those tickets if you realize you made a mistake or you realize that you have a big work meeting or something like that you can't go right after you book those tickets.
Is this something that's changed in recent years?
The rule's been on the books for a while. Actually, it's a Department of Transportation rule that requires major U.S. airlines to offer either 24 hours to cancel the ticket after it's purchased, as long as it's purchased at least 7 days before departure, or they have to offer you the option of holding the ticket at no charge for 24 hours at the quoted fare. Recently, actually, at the beginning of this month, American Airlines, they were the only major airlines that was requiring the hold as opposed to the cancellation. They've made the switch as well. So all of your major U.S. carriers have that 24-hour window now, and the Feds are actually going to be looking at it again. Probably, I would expect some news on it over the summer, examining how far this rule extends, perhaps extending it a little bit further to travel agents or something along those lines, but we'll have to wait and see.
Is that because flyers have been complaining?
I think that right now there's a bit of a discrepancy. The rule applies to airlines. So if you book a ticket directly through one of those major carriers within the U.S. or flights originating within the U.S. for international flights, it applies to them, but there's a little bit of a gray area right now with third-party booking sites like Expedia and Priceline. Most of them are extending a similar courtesy, but their policies can be a little bit different because they're not regulated in the same way for travel agents. But the Department of Transportation is expected to be looking at this, and hopefully we'll see a decision this summer.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Caitlin Pitzger from Kiplinger's Personal Finance. It's 13 minutes now before the hour. On this weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
As a new hiking season beckons, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy is expecting a record number of hikers hoping to hoof the entire trail thanks to last year's movie A Walk in the Woods. That means the ever-growing roster of nicknames people get assigned on the trail is primed for its biggest expansion yet, because they keep track of this stuff. However descriptive, aspirational, clever, quirky, or bizarre these nicknames might be. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Scott Calvert. Scott, what's this about?
Well, first of all, I had no idea that nicknames were a thing on the Appalachian Trail. I kind of stumbled across it. And then I got a database from the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, which has a list of every through hiker, meaning somebody who's hiked the whole trail. They report their name and other things, including their nickname. And what I found out was that these days, virtually everybody who through hikes the trail or attempts to has a nickname of some sort. And they just run the gamut from all sorts of things you can think of. There are condiments like ketchup and mustard. There are, you know, descriptive words like, you know, Rocket Man, things like that.
Right.
Some people are very clever with the play on words. There's a guy who called himself the Abominably Slow Man, which I thought was kind of fun. But everybody's got one just about.
That's funny. So do you register it? I guess somewhere along the line you enter it somehow, right?
Well, what it is you when you've completed the hike, you know, you don't have to do this, but most people do tell the conservancy, yes, I hiked the trail, and here are some details, And one of the data fields is your trail name. And as I say, you know, almost everybody has one, and the Conservancy, you know, collects them. The way it works is some people give themselves a name, or other people just sort of wait and see what happens on the trail. And a lot of times what will happen is fellow hikers will give you your name based on something you did, maybe how you look, some funny thing that happened. It could be anything and everything under the sun, and that's pretty much how it works. I mean, you're not obligated to take a name that you don't like, and some people will do just that. But it's quite a ingrained part of the Appalachian Trail culture at this point.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Scott Calvert. He's got a piece called "In Springtime, Ketchup, Turtle, and Hot Pants Hit the Appalachian Trail," talking about the nicknames that people get when they hike the full nearly 2,200 miles from Georgia to Maine. All right, so I'd imagine you need to spend some sort of time on the trail with people in order to develop a nickname. So are these nicknames coming from like you know, when you set up tent for the night and you're hanging out with strangers?
Pretty much. I mean, there was a guy I talked to whose name is Jared, and he didn't go in with a trail name of his own. He figured, you know, he'd get one along the way. And sure enough, he was in North Carolina somewhere with some fellow hikers, and they decided to go for a quick swim in a lake. And afterwards, he wore these tights when he hiked. So afterwards, he's standing by the campfire, you know, wearing his wet tights to warm up and dry off. Mm-hmm. And the heat of the fire caused his pants to sort of steam. And somebody, you know, in the group said, "Hey, you know, look at those hot pants." And one of the other people said, "Hot pants, that's your name." And that's how he got his trail name. And as he put it to me, you know, for the next 1,900 miles all the way up to Maine, he was Hot Pants.
Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal reporter Scott Calvert. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. And now, right, Chicago Bulls fans, it's perhaps the most recognizable instrumental in sports. Players on the Golden State Warriors, who made history Wednesday night, are actually motivated by the song that's synonymous with the Chicago Bulls, the team whose single-season record for wins they beat this past week. Sirius, as it's known, by the Alan Parsons Project, is used by the Bulls for their starting lineups. Players on the Warriors grew up watching those Michael Jordan Bulls teams in the 90s enter the court to that song. The Bulls won 72 games in 1996. With Wednesday's win over Memphis in the final game of the regular season, the Warriors got their 73rd win. By the way, Alan Parsons never watched the Bulls play in person. In fact, he told the Wall Street Journal that he had no idea that the Warriors were even on the brink of history. He also admits he doesn't even know where the Warriors play. That'll do it for this program. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy for you to create your stunning website. Go to Wix.com and create your website today. It's easy and free. That's Wix.com.